Escape Pod 59. June 22nd, 2006. Today's story, Anyone Can Whistle, by David Walton.
Hello, welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely, and this is a Geek Spouse intro. It's very often been said that the best way to keep a relationship strong is to find things to do together. It doesn't really matter what, as long as it's something you both enjoy. I agree with that advice. I think it's one of the three best things about Anna's and my marriage. Number two is that we keep each other amused, and the third one I won't talk about here. Anyway, one of the things that we like to do most in the evenings is play games. Sometimes it's card games. We made it through a whole season of American Idol with Gin Rummy and Whiskey Shots. But more often, it's video or computer games. For the last couple of years, we've been slowly making our way through the games on the PlayStation 2 that have cooperative play modes, where you can go through and bash monsters together instead of fighting each other. The trouble is, there's not that many of them. We've finished both Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance games. We don't really care for the EverQuest clones. And Gauntlet's just not as much fun as it was in the old arcade days. Some of our best gaming hours have come from the old Final Fantasy games. A lot of the PlayStation conversions had a mode where you could play with two controllers, and each take half the party. We really enjoyed that. But we just finished Final Fantasy IX last week, and that was the last game that allowed it. That created a problem for us, because we think we've played most or all of the co-op video games that don't suck. I have no idea why there aren't more of them. We can't be the only couple that plays games together. At least, I hope we're not. And you'd think that with such a wide-open market, game companies would be seeing dollar signs there. But they're not. So we went looking for alternatives, and Anna remembered the old Diablo 2 nights we used to have. That was a grand old time. We'd have 6 or 8 friends all logging on at the same time, and forming one big party to joke around and cleanse the world of evil. And we thought, hey, we could do that again. So we went looking for today's answer to Diablo 2. There is no exact duplicate, but the closest we found was Guild Wars. I'll have more to say about Guild Wars later on. We've just started it, but it's already provoking a lot of thought. Anyway, I'm not going to make this a gamer cast. The point here is that there's a lot of untapped potential in games like this, where you aren't competing with your friends or partners, but working together. And at least for me and Anna, we've found it's one of several things that keeps us together. And amused. I won't say what it does for number three. So, let's get to today's story. We present Anyone Can Whistle by David Walton. It also has things to say about cooperation and relationships in a virtual world. Mr. Walton lives in Pennsylvania with his wife and 4 children, and has had stories published in Neverworlds, Futurismic, and an upcoming piece in Analog. He's also a moderator for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and is a prolific inventor of brain teasers, with some really fiendish puzzles at Chronigma.com. The story is read for us today by J.R. Blackwell of 365tomorrows.com and its podcast, Voices of Tomorrow. 365 Tomorrows is a hugely ambitious project to put up a new science fiction story every day for a year. If you're looking for more great short fiction, you really need to check this out. So, chmod this to World Readable, because it's story time.
Anyone Can Whistle by David Walton. Whistle while you work had never been my motto. I didn't even know you could whistle in a VR development tank, but somehow Emil managed it. In the tank, Emil looked about the same as everyone else, the same dull red uniform, angular face, fluid grace of movement, but it was easy to pick him out. His incomparable stupidity made him unmistakable. "Planning on finishing that before next week?" I asked him. His avatar was expressionless, but I could imagine the foolish grin. He held up the collection of objects he'd been working on. I grunted. "Emil, your translation object is using the wrong algorithm. You want to convert from clock counts to nanoseconds, not the other way around. Look at the design!" He looked at the design where it lay crumpled on the virtual floor. I got the distinct impression he'd forgotten it was there. "Sorry, Marta," he managed. "The whole group is waiting for you, Emil. If you don't get done soon, we won't be able to finish the program by the end of the week. Do you know what happens then?" Emil sighed. No more happy stuff. That's right. No more group therapy for any of us. Just work all the time. How would that feel? He didn't answer. Stay here, I told him. I'll go to the library and get you the right object. Just don't try to fix anything. I stalked off toward the library, shaking my head in disbelief. Emil put me on edge like a cat in a car wash. Why couldn't he get it? Ever since the Dukjas came, programming had been as easy as building with wooden blocks. The Dukjas came up with the design. All we had to do was put them together, object by object. No thought required. But Emil didn't seem capable of even the simplest tasks. True, it was genetic, nothing he could do about it. Why did he have to be assigned to my group? It was frustrating to have my brain limited to such mindless labor, never mind having to deal with Emil. I would have loved to learn more about the Dukjas' computer systems. They worked on an entirely different principle than the old 20th century machines. Instead of binary switches, on or off, they used non-discrete bits that could hold any value based on temperature differentials. But it didn't matter whether I could understand the math or not. To the Dukjas, we were useful only as a labor class, assembling the objects they created according to their design. They even invented this virtual world for us, a fifth-generation language, they called it, so easy, even an imbecile could program in it. I arrived at the object library, represented as a drab brick building at the edge of the development area. The firewall loomed to my left, blocking us from the rest of the file system, a chafing reminder of our limits. How I longed to get past it, to let my cramped intelligence stand up and stretch. But that was impossible. The Dukjas never said that we weren't allowed to think too much, but we knew all the same. I felt like a lion trapped in a grazing pen, trying to feed on grass when miles of uncharted hunting ground lay beyond that wall. When I got back with the right object, our Dukja was already there, directing all the programmers to log off. Her avatar was humanoid, like the rest of us, but she was a little taller and clothed in white. She was also the only one without a name printed boldly across her chest. "Time for group therapy, Marta," she told me in a cheery voice. "Where have you been?" I didn't point out that she could find out my location just by thinking about it. "I was in the library, ma'am," I said, hanging my head. "Your group is lagging behind. You better step up the effort if you want to keep your therapy privileges." "Yes, ma'am." "Log off and go to the auditorium, then. Don't dally." I nodded, relieved. It had been a long morning, with no respite from the whistling wonder. Therapy would refocus me, as always. I dropped the object into the pouch that represented my user-level storage area and pulled the little cord near my head, yanking my awareness back to the real world. The auditorium was the largest room in the New Mexico Development Tank 53. The circular arrangement of chairs could seat the entire population of the tank, which it did once a day for group therapy. The sea of 300 red uniforms included not only programmers, but hardware technicians, janitors, cooks, and all the other human beings who lived in the tank and supported the programming work. Strangely, Emil wasn't sitting with our group. I wondered what he had done to get his therapy privileges taken away. In the center of the room, on a platform, was our Dukja. Not the humanoid body she took in VR, but a blue mass of flesh with dry, fish-like skin that pulsated as she breathed. She had no definitive shape, no arms or legs or tentacles or even a face. Her only prominent feature was a taut membrane stretched tightly over an opening at the top of her body. One section of that membrane was covered over with an elaborate breathing apparatus, and the familiar array of VR electrodes were attached to what must have been her central nervous system. I felt ill just looking at her, but I knew therapy would readjust my feelings. The Dukjas had saved us, hadn't they? 5 days after the cyber-terrorist war had gone global, the Earth's computer systems in complete disarray, they had appeared like the angels in Bethlehem, offering salvation. The governments of the world, fighting off rioting and economic collapse, had welcomed them with open arms. They landed the next day, bringing with them the medical technology to eradicate disease, a waste-free form of energy, And best of all, a computer system 1,000,000 times more powerful than the old one to network the world again. "I'm so happy to see you all," said the Dokja, her membrane pulsating. She could imitate virtually any sound of that organ, including a human voice. "It's such a joyful day. Aren't you all pleased to be working hard?" There were some happy nods around the room. Some people actually leaned forward in their chairs, but I tensed every muscle, trying to control the craving I felt for what was about to happen. "Does anyone feel sad today?" Half a dozen hands shot up instantly, like a kindergarten class. I wondered if anyone else had ever felt guilty at how easily we were being manipulated. "Does anyone feel angry?" A chorus in the affirmative.
"We're all angry," someone yelled.
The Dokja's too perfect human voice feigned shock. "Whatever for?" The murmur of the assembly grew louder, like a strong wind whipping up the tide. Why were we angry? Perhaps we still remembered what it was like to be in control of our own lives, free to think, free to act. The turn-of-the-century governments fell before the alien invasion like grain before a scythe. Not because we were powerless to defy them, but because we didn't have the desire. No one could resist the Dokja's offer. Why work for what can be obtained free of charge? Everything we had labored to achieve for ourselves could be obtained simply by doing nothing. With the impetus of greed erased, humanity showed itself surprisingly willing to let others make the decisions, but not without misgivings. By the end of each morning, the prod of conscience churned into an inexplicable rage that surfaced in our work, a rage which manifested itself now in growls and yells and furious curses. The Dokja started to sweat, her fish skin glistening. Fury crackled in the air, but no one left their seat, no violence broke out. No one wanted to risk a disruption that would deprive them of what was to come. It was a brilliant system. Our anger was encouraged, improved of. It became their tool just as surely as our complacency. The alien skin bubbled, little rivulets dribbling down her flesh to be absorbed by the cushions propped around her on the platform. Someone near the front stopped shouting and laughed, a little infectious giggle, and someone else near them chuckled along. Soon the whole front row was roaring, holding their sides and panting their mirth. The second row caught the fervor, and then the third, and the fourth, and suddenly the whole room erupted, close to 300 people, abandoning their rage and laughing uncontrollably. I resisted. I told myself it wasn't real. Nothing was funny. I was not happy. I was trapped in that tank like a slave, well-fed and well-treated, but with no choices of my own. They told us it would be harder for us, the first generation. The generation that still remembered what it was like to wander about recklessly, squandering time instead of using it efficiently. Our children would have it much better from the start, they told us. They would never learn to think for themselves. Everyone else was laughing now, tears streaming down their faces. A painful giggle swarmed up out of my own throat, but I fought it down. I held my jaw closed, pinched my throat until it hurt. But the wave rolled over me as it always did, and I was lost, laughing with the multitude, laughing and laughing until I gave way completely, overcome with the humor of all life and the pure glee of it, roaring with joy. What a gift these Dokjas had given us! What beautiful, noble creatures they were! How had we lived before they had come? I filed out of the auditorium as dazed as everyone else. Wiping my eyes and wandering into the direction of my room, my mind sugar-coated with imagined joy. I wasn't fooled into thinking it a spiritual experience, like some. I knew the only reason we laughed was a gaseous intoxicant excreted by the Dokja's skin. But who cared? We were drunk with it. The strain of the morning scraped free like leaves from a gutter, leaving us lazy and content. Resistance gained us nothing. I turned a corner and spotted Emil's towering form leaving his room. "Hi, Emil," I said amiably. "What'd you do?" He turned his key in the lock and started that infernal whistling, apparently not hearing me. I stood on tiptoe and shouted into his ear, "Emil!" Startled, he turned around, revealing a sunken, fleshy face with mongoloid eyes and prominent ears and nostrils. He was the last of his kind. No babies had been born with genetic defects since the Dukjas had taken over. His soft chin quivered, and he looked as if he might cry. At least he had stopped whistling. "I'm sorry I startled you," I said. "Are you okay?" His face was famous in the tank for the way he could contort it, and now his wide mouth stretched back into an exaggerated wince, teeth bared.
"That hurt," he said, rubbing his ear.
"I'm sorry," I said again, "but why weren't you at therapy? What did you do?" He dropped his gaze and started biting on one stubby hand. "Don't worry, Emil, you can tell me. What happened?" He grinned, lips spread wide.
"I don't like therapy," he announced. That surprised me. Surely he was just embarrassed and trying to hide whatever he had done. No one willingly gave up therapy. The craving was too strong.
"Emil, you can't just skip therapy. Now tell me what you did." His eyes scrunched up comically in thought, and it was all I could do not to break into laughter again. For the first hour after a therapy session, it's pretty easy to laugh.
"You leave him alone!"
I turned around to see Nina, a young woman who worked in the kitchens, stepping out of the woman's bathroom.
"Don't let her bother you," she said to Emil with a pert smile.
Emil's answering grin looked like it might split his face.
"What are you doing in this part of the tank?" I asked.
Her quarters were nowhere near this hallway.
She looked wryly amused.
"What's it to you?"
I noticed that the uniform she wore was about a size too big for her. Where'd she get such a baggy shirt? I took another look at Emil's goofy smile and made a quick connection.
"I'm guessing you weren't at therapy this morning either?"
Nina's smile vanished.
"You disgust me," I said. "Look at him. He doesn't know what he's doing."
"And how do you know what he can and can't do?"
"Come on, Nina. Anyone can see he's retarded."
"It's called Fragile X Syndrome," she said. "He can't react or learn the way you or I do, but he understands a lot more than you think. He may not grasp everything you say to him, but I know he loves me."
"Sure he does, like a faithful beagle, and he won't know how to let go."
"It's none of your concern."
"I'll make it my concern to keep you from taking advantage of him, though it's a bit late for that, isn't it?"
"Why are you suddenly his protector?" said Nina. "I treat him better than you ever do."
"A little kindness goes a long way," I sneered. "You'll be out of here in no time, off to the birthing center for a therapy-filled vacation, all expenses paid."
I suddenly felt a strong hand clamped down on my shoulder. It hurt.
"Don't fight," said Emil. "Yuck."
A bell sounded down the halls. Time to get back to work.
"Come on," I said, taking Emil's broad hand. Nina ran off. She was in the wrong part of the complex and would probably be late. No matter. In the birthing center, she would be pampered and rewarded with extra privileges when she had her baby. The Dukja encouraged children. They were apparently trying to breed a human race that would be of more use to them. One that didn't remember the freedom of the old ways and could be molded and instructed from birth. Having a baby was an easy way to get out of work and get extra therapy, and many women tried to get pregnant just for the vacation.
"That girl does not love you," I told him. "You just stick with me."
Emil just kept grinning.
"No, Marta. Nina loves me. You don't know how much."
I rolled my eyes, but didn't contradict him.
Back in development. Work was always better in the afternoon. There was less tension among the troops. I came out of the library again with a pouch full of objects, ready to start building another collection, when an avatar ran past with the name Emil boldly printed on its chest. As I stood there, astonished, he ran straight for the firewall and made a quick pulling motion with his hand. A section of the wall smoothed over into a flat screen. I set my pouch down on the steps and tiptoed over to him. The screen was filled with a crazy array of numbers and code, and he poked and prodded at them, changing numbers and letters and moving them around.
"What are you doing?" I asked, aghast.
He turned around sharply, and I could imagine his infernal grin.
"Playing with numbers," he said.
"Playing? Emil, you shouldn't play around with that. How did you do that, anyway?"
"Shh!" he said.
Don't tell.
With another flip of his hand, the screen dissolved back into the wall, and he stepped forward, right through the firewall. I was too flabbergasted to move.
Emil?
I put my hand out and touched the wall, then pushed harder, then finally threw myself against it. It was as solid as it looked, a thick, impassable barrier. I sat down to collect my thoughts. Those firewalls were designed and built by the Dukcha to be impenetrable. Changing the permissions was far from elementary. Was this some sort of elaborate hoax? Was Emil just pretending to be an imbecile so he could get away with something without being watched? I quickly discounted that notion. No one could fake that flat face with those high brows and sunken eyes. I had heard of autistics, outwardly retarded but with astonishing intellects buried deep inside. Could he be one of those? I rapped on the wall again. Solid. What had Nina called his disorder? Fragile X syndrome? I stepped back into the library, which held information as well as programming objects, and looked it up. Research quickly confirmed my hypothesis. Fragile X syndrome had been a common genetic cause of mental retardation in the previous century, and one that often produced autistic skill development, kids who could solve complex math problems but couldn't read the time from a clock. I feared for him now, wandering aimlessly where he wasn't supposed to go, with a hidden intellect capable of doing real damage, but not enough connection with reality to keep it under control. He didn't come back to work for the rest of the afternoon. I toyed with reporting him for his own sake, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. I couldn't be his babysitter. Let Nina have that job, if she wanted it. That evening, after supper, I set off to look for Emil. I had to talk to him, find out what he thought he was doing, and warn him away from it. Light trickled from beneath his door, and I knocked loudly. Emil answered.
Marta! He exclaimed happily, but Nina immediately appeared at the door beside him.
Please go away, she said.
You don't know what he did today, I told her. I need to talk to him. It's very important. Nina remained composed.
I do know what he did today. He's very grateful to you for not reporting him. But we need to be alone now. Please go away.
I hesitated. Emil had his big arm around her, holding her close to his chest, and she looked like she belonged there. Maybe I judged too quickly, I thought. Maybe she does love him. Maybe Emil's the genius, and I don't know anything. Sorry, I mumbled, and wandered away. It was hard to sleep that night. Carlos. How long had it been since I'd thought about him? He had been so smart and strong, too strong to go without a fight. We could have escaped, run off together, lived like animals in the Canadian forests or high in the Appalachians. But we never thought it would go so far. We never imagined that human beings would be so eager to pack their minds in the attic that they would silence opposing voices at any cost. I could remember that night only vaguely, like early childhood, with all the wrong details distinct, the street lights glinting on the asphalt like water on a black dog, the wet crack of metal against flesh, the acid taste of my own fear. But I could never remember his face on that night. Never his face. Why didn't they kill me, too? Because I could keep quiet where he couldn't. Because I feared their violence and did what they told me. Because I couldn't bear to live without their therapy. Emil and Nina, why did I resent their happiness? Was it because they could resist for just an hour to make love, while I gave in and laughed every time? It made me feel good. It took away the guilt for an hour or so. Would Carlos have understood? Would my darling have forgiven me? Did he know I could never really be happy without him? The next morning I worked in a frenzy. I tried to push Carlos, Emil, Nina, the Dukcha, all of it out of my mind, but Emil would not let me be. Don't be mad, Marta. Look, I brought you a present.
I looked up to see a tiny pebble nestled in an avatar hand. I'm not mad, Emil. I just want to work.
You'll like this. It's a toy.
I eyed the pebble again. Had he made a little object of his own? If so, it was probably dangerous to let him keep it. I decided to accept his little gift and hide it deep in my pouch.
Thank you, I said, and tried to take it from him. But as soon as I touched it, my head swam and my perspective shifted crazily. I now faced in the opposite direction, staring at an avatar with Marta printed on its chest. I knew without looking that my chest read Emil. Emil jumped up and down and clapped his hands.
It worked! It worked!
Emil, this is not funny. You switch us back right now, he laughed.
Funny! You're Emil!
Emil, I said, trying to keep my voice calm. If they catch us, they'll put us in solitary for a week. Actually, I thought they'll put me in solitary. They'd never believe Emil could have done anything so sophisticated. My avatar reached out its hand with the pebble again, and I took it. Immediately, I returned to my own body. I wanted to shout at Emil until his ears caught fire, but as soon as I got my bearings, he kissed me and said, "Thanks, Marta, don't tell," and ran off.
Well, if I wasn't going to report him, I could at least follow him and try to keep him from doing any real damage. Although I started only a few seconds after him, he had a good head start, and he headed straight for the firewall. I cursed under my breath as he stepped past it and out of sight. Tentatively, I approached the wall and put my hand against it. It felt airy, like a mist or a thin curtain. Wherever he was off to, he had been in too much of a hurry to change the permissions back again. If they caught me on the other side of the firewall, I'd be in deep trouble, but no worse than if they had noticed the swap of avatars. Showing any kind of independent thinking was grounds for long-term imprisonment. What was Emil doing back there, anyway? My curiosity outweighed my caution. I held my breath and stepped through the wall. My first view was of a vast, high-ceilinged room, crowded with rows of books, cabinets, and safes, representing all the files and directories of the tank's computer system, not one of which I was going to touch, I told myself. At the sight of all that forbidden material, I nearly turned back, but I spotted Emil running towards the far end of the room. Emil! I called after him. He didn't turn around, so I tiptoed from the wall, feeling like a dog in a tulip garden. I knew I didn't belong here, but it was fascinating all the same. I passed doors with brightly stenciled labels, electrical routings, air filtration, refrigeration, food replication, and all the other computer-driven systems of the complex. Surely Emil wasn't experimenting behind any of those doors. From the other end of the room, a yellow light glimmered. Emil reached it before I caught up with him. It was an open doorway, shining brightly, with no label to identify it, but I knew what it was. The gateway to the outside, the network to all the other computer systems in the world. I could see beyond that door. The floor dropped away into a vast depth of shining unknown. Emil ignored the glowing doorway, however, and dashed into the maze of cabinets and books. I pursued him, twisting and turning down several corridors until I had lost my way. I whirled around, trying to figure out which way I had come. What if Emil went back to the development area and left me lost in the maze? Emil! I shouted. He peeked around the bend. Marta, what are you doing here? He asked. Emil, please, take me back, I said. I'm afraid. You shouldn't have come. It's too late now, he said, and rushed around the corner again.
I followed him and saw him stop in front of a tightly locked safe labeled Breathing Apparatus. Immediately my mind was filled with an image of the Dukja sweating on her platform, breathing heavily through tubes and machines. Emil made a quick pulling motion with his hand, and the front of the safe became a plane of scrolling numbers and letters, just as it had on the firewall. I was horrified. If he deleted the program that controlled the Dukja's breathing apparatus, she could die, and then what would the other Dukjas do to us?
You leave that alone, I shouted. They could kill us for messing with that.
Don't worry, Marta, he said. I can open it, no problem.
That wasn't what worried me. I was afraid to stay, but afraid to leave him, too. Even if I found my way back to the wall, there was no guarantee I could get back through it. I could have pulled the cord to jerk me back to the real world, but my avatar would stay where I left it, undeniable evidence that I had been here. It was crazy that I was relying on Emil to get us back safely. He was stooped over the safe, prodding and shifting lines of code I understood nothing about.
In the real world, his face would be twisted into a caricature of concentration, and I would have laughed at him. But here it was different. He seemed more confident, more in his element. The door to the safe opened. Emil reached inside and started pulling out collections of objects linked together, started taking them apart. "Emil," I pleaded, "please put those down and take me back." Too late. I turned around in time to see another avatar materialize next to us. It was human in shape, like us, but white, bright white, and it glowed. I knew what that glow meant: root privileges, command of the whole system, and complete power to manipulate it like a god. "It's the Dukcha!" I yelled to Emil, and I reached at my cord, but it was already gone. A metal cage sprang into place around me, and another one around Emil. The objects flew from his grasp and back into the safe, which slammed shut and flew far out of his reach. The Dukcha said nothing. I groped again for my cord, but it wasn't there. There was no way out. I could be trapped in this virtual world forever without regaining my body. Finally, the Dukcha turned her gaze to me. "Marta, who taught you how to do this?" "It was an accident," I spluttered. I just fell through the wall. I didn't know where I was." My cage grew smaller and smaller until I had to crouch and duck my head between my knees. A sudden thought struck me. The Dukcha had me trapped in this virtual world against my will. Could she make me feel pain here? Even kill me?
"I saw the holes in the wall," the Dukcha growled, "and you put them there."
My courage deserted me. "No," I wailed, "I don't know anything about it. He dragged me here. Please let me go back." Emil started to tremble in his cage. The Dukcha turned her eyes to him, and I knew I would hate myself forever if I lived to see the real world again. "You were the first through the wall," she said to him. "It must be you who knows the trick. Tell me." Emil backed against the bars of his cage, and I despaired. I thought him so clever, but she had been watching us all along, amused at our antics like a cat holding a mouse by the tail.
"I did it with this," said Emil meekly, and held out a tiny object the size of a pebble. The Dukcha peered close, and then reached out and took it from his hand.
There was no flash of light, no explosion, but I knew he had done it. Just as had happened to me when I took the tiny object from Emil's hand, Emil and the Dukcha swapped avatars. A second passed, and then the avatar in the cage screamed in horror. Emil, prancing with glee on the outside of the cage, his white avatar glowing merrily, flicked a hand at me, and my cage disappeared. I backed away as he sent the Dukcha, trapped in his avatar, flying high above us, and latched her cage from a beam in the high roof. He pointed at the safe that held the Dukcha's breathing apparatus, and it disappeared instantly.
"Now get out! Quickly!" he shouted to me.
He spread his arm in a huge arc, and I watched the shelf upon shelf of cabinets and books crash to the floor and disappear. He was deleting the tank's entire file structure. The closed doors all swung open together, spilling out objects which immediately dissolved away. He backed up towards the glowing doorway, still deleting everything in sight.
"Go!"
he shouted at me again. I reached for my cord, found it had reappeared, and pulled. Before my vision blacked out, I saw Emil sweep his arm a final time and then throw himself into the shimmering abyss. I found myself back in the real world, my real body around me, breathing real air and feeling safe, at least for the time being. Everyone else was awake, too, disconnecting their electrodes and jabbering nervously about being suddenly logged off early, before the Dukcha had arrived. I played along as best I could, feigning ignorance and telling them I had been in the library when it had happened. As we learned over the next few days, Emil spent the next hour leaping from node to node around the entire world, using the Dukcha's stolen privileges to steal access to other tanks and delete entire file systems, including the Dukcha's computer-controlled life support. In that short hour, before they tracked him down, he killed over a dozen of our oppressors. That 1 hour was how long it took for them to track down the location of his physical body, then send one of the loyal human cronies to walk into the development area and slit his throat. They left him there, his fleshy mouth hanging slack, never again to contort in comic frustration or spread into that stupid grin. I believe they might never have caught him in the virtual world alone, the world where he thrived,
overcoming his physical limitations. If only there was some way he could have left his body behind to live only in the computer, like a virtual Robin Hood. He might have killed them all before they caught him. I realized he had intentionally opened the Dokcha's safe in order to lure her close enough to steal her avatar and its root privileges. I remembered all the wrong objects I had scolded him for taking out of the library, and wondered whether they had been mistakes after all. How many objects had he hidden away in his pouch for other uses? Nina found us almost immediately after the system collapse. I wondered how much she had known of what he had intended to do, or how much of it she had prompted. The night before, when I interrupted them in his room, had she known she was saying goodbye? When they finally let her in, she threw her arms around him, weeping and shrieking, kissing his face, his eyes, his hands. No one watched too closely. Lifting one of his stubby hands, she placed it on her belly and pressed close to him, her tears smearing on his cheek. She found a note in his pocket. It was simple and short, like everything Emil had ever spoken aloud. "So our child can grow up free," it said. When I saw that note, I felt a strange oneness with Emil, as if I had somehow been a part of his defiance. But I knew this romantic fancy was only an attempt to disguise the bald truth that he had resisted, and I had not. Despite a debilitating genetic disorder, he had fought back where I had been weak. I know Carlos would have been proud of him. Emil didn't save the world, or even change it much, but he changed me, and someday I will resist, like Carlos, like Emil, when I find a way. And if I die, then maybe another will be moved by my stand to make one themselves. One day, we will triumph. I wish I could better remember the way he smiled with Nina's arm wrapped tightly around him. All I can bring to mind is a white avatar backing towards the network doorway and wielding its graceful destruction like Samson in the temple, like Othello on his bed. And one last detail, like a fairy tickling the back of my brain, before my avatar jerked away, as he leapt into that shining void, I could have sworn I heard him whistling.
And that was our story. If aliens ever do invade our planet, I could recommend a few good network security podcasts for them to listen to. Today's promo is a little bit different because, well, I made it. I don't generally get into podcasting politics here on Escape Pod, even though I'm an incorrigible smartass on the subject everywhere else. But an upcoming event inspired me to make this, and if you're a podcaster, I encourage you to pass it on.
Attention! Attention! It's the 2006 Podcast Awards! For the second year, you can be part of the action by telling your listeners to nominate your podcast every day! And then vote for your podcast every day! So join the banner ad-driven excitement and help us to honor those podcasts with the biggest audiences who are willing to annoy those audiences by begging the most! Only at podcastawards.com.
That's why I don't plead with you for votes on any of those podcast sites. Because it's annoying. If you like Escape Pod and you want to help us grow, the best thing you can do isn't to go to some site you don't care about and fill out a form. It's to tell a friend, or spread the word about us in the communities you do care about. That's a lot more sincere, and it helps us more. And that's enough podcast snarkiness for another 6 months or so. Last week's story, Shadow Boxer, by Paul DeFilippo, was an unusual piece for us, and it got a lot of response. Fortunately, all of it was positive, and several listeners wrote in to say that they thought it was the best story we've run. Simon said in our blog comments, "The story wasn't all that inventive in greater terms. We have all encountered this sort of tale before. What was special about this was the rhythm, the narrative breaks for this guy to discuss his motivations, that gave it a really Kafka-esque claustrophobia. This guy can write." Thanks, Simon. I happen to agree, and we hope to run more DeFilippo in the future. We've also got a featured listener this week. It's been a long time for that, but we've just got to feature Jonathan, Rachel, and their family. Jonathan sent us a very generous donation and included this note, which I have to present verbatim. Quote, "The other thing is kind of strange. Somehow, you have become the boogeyman in our house. When my kids, all girls, aged 8, 4, and 4, aren't moving at bedtime and they need motivating to get into the bath, my wife has taken to yelling, 'If you don't get into the bath now, the only story you'll get tonight will be from Steve Ely.' They all proceed to leap up and run around, frantically shedding clothes, yelling, 'No, not Steve Ely!' They sound desperate, scared, trapped. I don't know how it happened, but my wife and I hide in the bedroom in pain from laughing at this strange phenomenon." End quote. And that is the funniest story I have ever heard about Escape Pod's influence on our listeners. Thanks, Jonathan and all of you, for your support, and for letting me know about my power to scare children by invocation. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. So you can scare anyone you want to with it, but do not charge them for the privilege. Our music is by permission of Dai Kaiju, scaring monsters with their hard, eclectic surf rock, which is why you so rarely see any nowadays. That was our show for this week. We close with a quote from Eli Kamarov, who said, "Most people are awaiting virtual reality. I'm awaiting virtuous reality." Thanks for listening, and until next week, have fun.